I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Today, I look at the art world from two angles, from someone in it and from someone who has observed that world from a distance. Writer Michael Schneerson's latest book, Boom, gives an exhaustive history of how today's art market came to be. Art dealer Richard Feigen spent his entire career in that market. We'll start with Michael Schneerson. He grew up in New York. His first writing job was as the sports editor of the Santa Fe Reporter in New Mexico. He made $100 a week, but it led to a job at Time Magazine, then to Avenues, and finally Vanity Fair, where he has published over 75 feature stories. Schneerson writes books, too. He's collaborated with Harry Belafonte, written A Portrait of Andrew Cuomo, and unpacked General Motors and the electric car. For his latest book, Boom, Schneerson interviewed more than 200 art dealers. Whenever he writes a book and Boom is his seventh, he becomes lost in the world of his subject.
One reason that I undertook those books was to immerse myself in the different worlds. I mean, I found Albany a fascinating world and very, in its own way, sort of exotic one.
How so? Let's talk about that. This is the Cuomo biography.
You know, it's often said that when you drive from New York to Albany, let's say you're a representative of some kind, by the time you get halfway there, you know, you're within this realm that is completely apart from Manhattan. And, you know, there's a kind of pervasive corruption in Albany. It's so pervasive that everyone acknowledges it, basically. Mm-hmm. There's virtually no rules or very modest ones on campaign contributions. Mm-hmm. You can give anything through...
It's beyond cynicism there.
Yeah, it's beyond cynicism. I found that fascinating. Did I learn more about Cuomo because of it? Cuomo's a very complicated, dark guy who's sort of haunted by his father. Harry Belafonte, it occurs to me, is someone who was always haunted by his father.
Now with Andrew Cuomo, who I don't know well, I've met him many times, and of course, like anybody who participates on any level, especially a level that can involve check writing, you have Cuomo lieutenants reaching out to you.
Sure.
But he's a guy who I was always kind of fascinated somewhat by that relationship with his father, because he's so much more of a retail politician than his dad, you know. But and their mother was this wonderful woman.
Oh yes,
she was this dynamic, and
everybody
loved
adored
her.
Yeah,
adored her. Matilda Cuomo was always, "How's your mom? And how's your mom's breast cancer thing?" You know, she knew that game inside and out, and she did it sincerely. She was a very warm woman, and Cuomo would be standing there, Cuomo Senior, and it was like he had a hair shirt on. He just couldn't wait for everybody to get the hell away from him and he can go home and
read a book. That's very perceptive. I mean, he was seen as, written as, being this avuncular, warm, empathetic, you know, true Democrat. In fact, he was a very tough father on Andrew. Maybe one thing to be gleaned here is that almost everybody's got a father problem.
Right. Well, this dynamic between fathers and sons, what was Belafonte's like in terms of, because when I met him, he was a pretty no-nonsense guy. Tough guys beget tough sons, can.
Mm-hmm.
What was Belafonte's relationship with his father like?
They grew up partly in Jamaica. His father was a sailor. In some sort of military marine situation. When he came home, he was really abusive to his son. I mean, physical violence. I remember Harry describing a moment when his father, Harry had done something wrong, and his father said, "We're going to take care of this." And he made Harry fill the bathtub with absolutely scalding water. And then he told him to come over to the bathtub and put his foot in. And just as he was about to put his foot in, the father sort of pushed him away. And that wasn't the only time he did something like that. At one time, I remember Harry saying that his father took a lit cigarette and put it to his leg. So that was pretty extreme. And I think it made Harry a very tough character indeed. Very tough, but at the same time...
He did seem tough when I met him.
Yeah.
He did not suffer fools when I met him. He really, really seemed like somebody who... He had a chip on his shoulder.
Can I tell you a little story? Because it's just one of the great stories from that book. I hope it's okay if we venture a little bit away from art. So Harry had served in the military, in the army, of course, in a black regiment outside of Chicago. If you were black, you were in a black regiment. There was no integration. And he came back. He didn't know what to do. So he worked as a janitor in Harlem. And one day, one of his the people in the building said, "Harry, could you help fix my broiler or something?" So he fixed the broiler, and she said, "Well, I want to pay you by giving you these two theater tickets. And it's for free. It's something called the American Negro Theater," was, I think, the name. So Harry had never seen a play, and he went down alone to see this play. And he was absolutely gobsmacked. It was very contemporary, involved black soldiers coming back from the war, trying to readjust. So he goes up to the founders afterwards, the directors of this theater, says, "I want to help. I want to do anything I can." And they say, "Really? Okay, well, if you want to move the props around, come on back." So he comes back. He starts moving the props around. And he's below that area of the stage, you know, whatever you call it, where the orchestra's pit is or whatever. Mm-hmm. He's moving things around. And this very surly guy is moving them around too. And Harry finally says, "You're not talking much. Is that because you were just in jail?" And the guy freaks out. He says, "Why would you think that?" And Harry says, "You know, just because that's sort of, I got a sense when people are in jail, have been." He says, "Well, I can't talk about that." And he says, "Well, what's your name?" And he says, "Sidney Poitier." And this is how Harry and Sidney Poitier met. And it was the beginning of their, like, 70-year friendship, which continues to this day.
Sure. Were there white artists, writers, thinkers that he trusted, that he thought really cared about the movement?
You know...
Some that he respected.
I don't have that recollection. What I have is actually the opposite sort of recollection, which is a white guy whom he trusted explicitly because the guy was his therapist. And actually, the guy's last name was Kennedy. I've forgotten his first name. It wasn't anything to do with the Kennedy family.
Right.
And as it turned out, the guy was a spy for the FBI. And J. Edgar Hoover was using
planted
him.
Planted someone.
Yeah. And so, you know, imagine the sense of betrayal you feel if you're Harry Belafonte and your own therapist has been reporting on you to J. Edgar Hoover, a white therapist, just to clarify. So I don't know. I think
just when I thought my opinion of Hoover couldn't go down any lower.
I have to say, I think that he came to trust me, and we had a very, very strong friendship, which continues.
I'm wondering, as I hop over to the world of art and your current book, Boom, did writing this book lead you to look at art differently than you had before?
Yeah, I think it did. I mean, I'm quick to say on page one of this book that I am not an art critic, neither before nor after.
You never collected
art. I never collected art.
You didn't have friends that were gallerists or artists?
I had a few. To be honest, I first got into this story because some of the stories I did for Vanity Fair were about contemporary art.
There's Sonia one Friedman.
Yes. You know, the whole Nodler Gallery, which we...
Ann Friedman.
Ann Friedman, yeah. which we have discussed. And, you know, I found those stories fascinating. That was the first thing. I also was intrigued always by Larry Gagosian, you know, the top dog of the whole contemporary art dealer world. And I'd wanted to write about him, and I would always be told, forget it. And it took me a while to realize that, of course, I would never get to write about Gagosian because he was a sacred cow, because Cy Newhouse, the head of, the head of the company, had bought a lot of art and was buying more. I mean, you know, Gagosian had sat in an auction room with Cy Newhouse, and they had bid a work up to $17 million. So, of course, I wasn't going to be allowed to write about him. Anyway, it was fine. Time passed. I thought, This subject is too big. I've been thinking I'm going to write about the whole contemporary art world and how it got this way from the late 40s until now, and it's going to involve collectors,
Castelli,
and curators,
yeah,
and dealers and artists.
Father-in-laws, and townhouses.
Right, well, yes.
All of them.
But I'd just taken on too much. So how was I going to reduce it? Well, it finally occurred to me the answer was to winnow it down to the dealers, because, you know, there's no art without artists, but there's actually no art without dealers either. Mm. And they had been kind of at the center of this story from the beginning. And they were a very interesting group of people. So that's how I got going.
You know, when I've met Gagosian, you know, there's something about him that's so exciting and so kind of, because he has an energy to him, like, you want to believe that there's a rakishness to him. To me, the only person that could play a Gagosian in a movie about him is dead. It would be John Garfield. There's a tough, tenacious quality. I mean, you want to believe that Gagosian began his career by like hijacking a truck. Someone said, "Listen, kid." A bunch of people like he just there's a toughness to him.
Sure.
There's a kind of a veneer to him. He's really kind of a tough guy, and warm.
You know, so many things come to mind as you speak, Alec. I mean, one thing is just to the point about his charm. It's fascinating. If he wants something from you, and I hear this again and again, then he's the most charming guy in the world. And he loves, I mean, there are these billionaires who are his clients. You know, he's what they call collector-centric versus artist-centric. Mm-hmm. You know, he's realized a long time ago that if you can get Ron Perlman or whoever else, Steve Cohen, to be at your table and come to your parties and then buy the art.
Yeah.
You're going to be
they
in great
go hand
shape.
In hand.
Not long ago, I was in the restaurant Sedimezzo, and I overheard this little snippet of conversation. I guess it was around the holidays, and this heavyset guy, older guy, leaned toward someone at the next table and said, "Going down to St. Bart's for Christmas." And the other guy said, "Oh, well, you know, you're gonna see Larry? Yeah, we're gonna see Larry. And where are you gonna stay?" And the other guy said, "Oh, we just always stay with Larry. We stay with Larry." And what that meant was that this guy has bought a lot of art from Larry.
He's a prized customer.
And that's why he gets invited. Not because of his charm, which he probably thought he had.
Right.
Anyway, so, you know, Gagosian's charm is, it turns on and off as need be. He's also described as someone who can be very, you know, just turn a cold shoulder on you, just look right through you, depending on if you are necessary to him or not.
When you look at this line from Castelli, we'll say that's the line, even though there are other people that you write about as well, in the abex world, as you call it, this line from Castelli on to Gagosian and these people who are making a market, these people who've convinced other people, would you say that who was, are they equivalent? Because if I read the book correctly, what you're saying is that these men and some women, they got rich people to turn this into a currency.
Sure.
So who do you think it is? It's Castelli and who else?
Well, so to go back, you know, to the beginning of Gagosian, I find it just fascinating that he grew up in the way he did in an Armenian community in Fresno, California. You know, his parents, I think, were Americans, but his grandparents on both sides were immigrants from Russia. And, you know, this is very at odds with the template, if you will, for contemporary art dealers. Contemporary art dealers tend to be, you know, to have started as rich fops. Their parents have art on the walls. Their parents know the dealer who will give the kid a job. I mean, this is how these things tend to come up. So when you get a guy like Gagosian who didn't even know what art was growing up, never a piece of art on his apartment, and the father we talked about, the father actually was an accountant, did okay, but you know, as Larry later said, he never heard of anybody who had two cars. He never heard of anyone who went to the country for the weekend. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was just amazed to hear that when he finally got into the art business. And so, you know, to hear that and then to get that wonderful story, I mean, it's just so classic. You know, he gets out of USC. He doesn't know what he's going to do. He is actually gets a job at the William Morris Mailroom, the classic starting job, except that he hates working for people like Mike Ovitz. And he's either fired or he quits, whatever. He's out of there. And then he spends a few years just working like for a record store, a grocery store, you know, doesn't have any ambition at all, which is quite bizarre when you think of how ambitious he really is. And then at a certain point, he gets a job that has him working as a parking lot manager. Okay, mm-hmm. So he's in his parking lot. He looks down the street and there's a guy taking framed prints out of the trunk of his car and selling them, as it turns out. And Larry's kind of fascinated. And so he looks into this and he finds out where these posters are made and he gets his own posters. And, you know, it's the thing about him. He didn't look at the guy selling posters and think, well, maybe I'll try to sell something else. He was very pragmatic. If the posters sold, he would do posters. Right. And as he later said, you know, if the guy had been selling widgets, he'd probably be selling widgets now.
He was selling fidget spinners.
Yeah, right.
Something inane.
Right. Yeah. So so he starts.
But didn't he got a pop-up store? Didn't he go get a store in Westwood?
Yes, exactly right. He starts doing this on the street, just like the other guy, trunk of his car. And then because he is framing these things, it occurs to him maybe he should have a little framing store. And so he does that. And then he gets a little more ambitious and he has a little gallery. So he's framing and he's trying to sell the work. But he realizes that he's nowhere out there. I mean, it's in Westwood, L.A. It's not a bad community. There's some wealthy people in the movie business. But he knows he has to come to New York and try to ingratiate himself. And that leads him to come in 1979 and to actually meet Castelli. And that's where the whole art world sort of begins turning into an art market.
How does he meet Castelli?
One day he's in his LA gallery and he's looking through a art magazine and there are these really cool abstract photographs by a guy named Ralph Gibson, who just parenthetically I happen to know because he would do the photo shots for Avenue magazine. So I would go to Ralph's studio and we would choose these really cool shots and they would go on the cover of the magazine. At any rate, Ralph gets a call from Gagosian who says, you don't know me, but I like your photos and I'd like to have a show of them here in California. And there's a pause on the line and Ralph says, but I'm in New York. And Gagosian says, oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were in L.A. But how about if I take the pictures anyway? And Gibson says, well, if you want to fly here and introduce yourself, then, you know, we could talk about that. So Gagosian flies out. He arrives on his own and he meets Gibson. They're both actually very handsome, charming guys. I mean, they really are charismatic.
Ready to take on the world.
Yeah, yeah. And they liked each other a lot. And so Gibson says, hey, before you go back, you got to meet my agent, my dealer, you know, Leo Castelli. And as soon as Castelli and Gagosian met, it was, you know,
a spark.
A spark. And you wouldn't have expected that because they're so different.
Right.
He's a Italian-born kid.
Took the mother's maiden name.
Yeah, took the mother's maiden name because he was Jewish and the war was looming. He learns five languages. He's a very debonair guy, comes to New York, eventually starts this gallery, as you said, on East 77th Street, becomes the sort of reigning king of pop art. And is very generous in his dealings both with artists and with other dealers. He's actually the one who pioneers this idea of splitting deals with far-flung dealers because instead of trying to make their money as much as they can in their own shops, why not share the connections? And then everyone will eventually do well. And so this network was a new concept and totally not what Gagosian would have done. This was very much Castelli. And, you know, Gagosian was charismatic, but he was also a very aggressive guy. Why he hadn't showed that before, I don't know. But now he was very aggressive. And he started selling paintings, much as he had the framed posters in L.A. He just was sort of a guy who would buttonhole you on the street and say, I know you're a dealer. You might be interested in this guy's work. And
like people, they said that Ralph Lauren used to sell ties to people tableside. Lauren would like walk up to people and show them like his collection of ties.
That's so funny. That's basically, I mean, and that's the way Gagosian was regarded, as a totally bumptious kind of, you know, arriviste or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there was one person who didn't agree with that take, and that was Castelli.
Would people tell you, who knew Castelli, that he was really very astute about art, that he knew good art, or was he the same as Gagosian, was all about markets and he just was the first?
Well, that's a good question. You know, people are always talking about an eye. Does this guy have an eye? Does he have a good critical eye? Can he really recognize which is the good painting and which is not the good painting? And it was assumed by everybody that Leo Castelli had a great eye. But those who are real cognoscenti in this world would tell you that it was actually his wife, Ileana Sonnabend, who had the great eye. But, you know, you talk to a really, really smart critic like Robert Storr, who was the head of the Yale Art School, and he would say it was Ileana all the way, and Castelli was just riding on her eye. You know, well, that's not a very good analogy, but right. Was riding on her judgment.
On her judgment. Yeah.
Robert Storr, the great authority I've just quoted here, would be just as quick to sort of disparage Gagosian as he was to disparage Castelli. He would say that, no, Gagosian is just a retail guy. That was his, he's just a retail guy. But, you know, I don't think that's fair. I remember I said not long ago that I am not an art expert, I'm not an art critic. But I will say that virtually every artwork, every artist that Gagosian has represented that I've gone to see, I've just felt excited and drawn to that art. And people who really are in this business are actually very respectful of Larry's eye. He's really got it. And when you walk into his gallery, it's not just the art, but it's the frames, back to the frames. But now there, you know, it's no simple frames in L.A. out of the trunk. It's beautiful frames and it's beautiful floors and it's actually, you know, very attractive people to, you know, usher you in. I mean, it's all really done perfectly. And of course, he's also the one who had, I don't know if the eye is the right way of putting it, but the sense, the prescience to start expanding, not only to another gallery in New York, and there were a few who had two galleries in New York, but to the rest of the world. So I don't even know what the count is, whether it's 17 galleries or 19.
It's somewhere between
17 and 19. We'll have to see how it settles. But, you know, this was a guy who made his first move in that regard in about 2000 when he went to London. And there's a cute little story. It just takes a minute because it's charming. Larry had no thought of going to London. He was settled in New York. But he had someone who worked for him, a lovely woman named Molly Dent Brocklehurst. There's a name for you. And she was, as you might expect, a very blue blood person. She was from, she was English. And she worked for Larry in his New York gallery, and the flagship across from the Carlisle Hotel. And one of her artists that she handled for him was Damien Hirst. And Damien Hirst, you know, we could talk for hours about Damien Hirst, but the fact is hugely successful, and the kind of artist that Gagosian liked best, the kind who could churn out stuff, you know, like on a production line. Mm-hmm. And so Molly was very important to Gagosian because she was the go-between with Damien Hirst. And one day she said to Larry, I'm sorry, I've got to leave you because my father's just died. There's a castle in the family and I have to go tend to the castle. And Larry took a beat and he said, well, why don't you just open a Gagosian office in London? And then you can tend to your castle and Damien Hirst is there anyway, and you can sell some art. And so that's exactly what happened. That happened to be just the time that the Russian oligarchs were starting to come over. Mm-hmm. And so there was this whole new, you know, vein of big money.
Right.
And Larry didn't know that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. It just happened out of serendipity.
There's a lot of luck involved with this.
There
career.
Is a lot of luck, yeah.
Now, you touched on Mary Boone.
Yes.
Who I have my own history with.
So I'm told.
I just want to ask, you know, in the way that people build these careers, because part of that experience for me, I looked at it. It was kind of inexplicable.
Mm.
You know, when I went through what I went through, which was, you know, very specifically to purchase a painting by a painter in a certain year, and let's say that year was 2010 or 2011, and I pay a five-figure sum for that painting.
Yeah.
And then I say, I want you to go find me this other painting that's an older painting that might be worth twice as much as that or more. And you then sell me that painting. I think you're selling me that painting, but what we find out is it's a copy you had made of that painting.
Yes.
And yet you charge me the amount of money. This was kind of the undoing of the whole thing for her.
Yes.
Was when you represent that you charge me $190,000 when I just bought the other one from you 2 weeks ago for $85,000. Why would I pay you $190,000 for the one when I just paid you $85,000 for the one that was fresh? You know, there was a lot of things that made it difficult for her to escape responsibility. And when she settled with me, I mean, it's all on public record. She, you know, she writes me a check for $1 million to go away. And my point is that we all sat there, the statute of limitations had passed in terms of the criminal, and we get ready to do a civil trial, and we're gonna go after a lot of emails of her, and they settle the case very quickly at that point, because you realize she didn't wake up one day and decide to do this to me that day.
No.
We wondered whether there was some, and I'm wondering, for someone who had a career like hers, it was so, you know, important.
Mm.
I mean, she represented people. She must, someone said to me, you know, she'll just turn around and take a Basquiat out of the bin that she has and sell it to cover her losses, you know, to her in this litigation. What do you think happened with someone like her? Why?
Well, here's what occurs to me to say. I mean, I've interviewed Mary. I interviewed her a good long time for the book. And then as the book was getting ready to be published, of course, she was sentenced.
Nailed for tax evasion.
And so I went to interview her again, and that actually became an article in Town and Country. So I spent quite a bit of time with her.
You interviewed after the sentencing?
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. Spent a little time in her gallery. I think she was still sort of trying to shape the narrative there and thought I could do this. And maybe she thought Town and Country was a pretty sympathetic audience, which I suppose it's fair to say it is. But I had, well, first of all, I had liked her. You know, she's easy to like. She's charming. She's sexy.
Very feline, yeah.
Feline is a great word for it. And and certainly in those early days, she showed enormous cleverness in how she built her business. By the way, Gagosian was the one who discovered David Sally. Mary Boone had a chance. She'd looked at his work early on, but she'd rejected it. She wasn't bold enough in that instance to think that that would work for her. But Gagosian went to see Sally's work, and he took a chance. He had rented a loft on the fifth floor overlooking 420 West Broadway, which 420 West Broadway was the big artist cooperative, Leo Castelli, the king of the realm. And so when Gagosian rented a loft space on the fifth floor, literally looking down at the kingdom, it was kind of almost creepy, you know? It was like he was looking down to what he was going to conquer one day.
He was rolling in the cannons.
Yes, he really was. And so he had this show for David Sally. It did very well. He sold quite a number of paintings. Mary Boone came across the street from her new little gallery at 420. And she ended up taking Sally because, you know, Gagosian at that point was just a guy from California. He didn't really know. He wasn't a dealer. He had to admit he was not yet a dealer. And that's actually what drove him to be kind of a different dealer. Instead of representing an artist's primary work, in other words, you find an artist, you discover him, he paints the painting, you take it and you sell it to a collector, that's primary. That's the primary market. If the art has been sold once, then it doesn't matter how it's sold the second time. Might be an auction, might be a private deal, whatever that. Then it's a secondary market. So Larry was always most interested in the secondary market because there was more money in it. Mm-hmm. It was usually a 50-50 situation. And because there was just more art to buy and sell. He would go to someone's house for dinner. He would see work on the walls. He would remember that someone else.
And you were dealing with people very often who were businessmen.
Yeah.
Meaning when you're dealing with artists, they're artists.
Yeah.
And, when I'm taking paintings that somebody who's the owner wants to sell, everybody realizes it's commerce.
Right. He did discover Basquiat very early on. I wasn't the first, but the second, I would say, in fairness to Larry. He did enormously well with Basquiat. But even so, that, again, was a primary artist. The work was selling for a few thousand dollars in the early 80s, whereas only a few years later, in the 80s, Gagosian was representing people like Cy Newhouse and probably getting half of a $17 million sale. So secondary work was really where the big money was. And that's where Gagosian went. The one other thing I would just say about Mary is that I think that what she did really shocked the whole art community, the whole art market. And I don't think that people do that sort of thing a lot. Now, having just said that, Larry Gagosian did have to give $4 million in change to the IRS for sending works that had been bought to a buyer's second residence and state rather than the first one. You know, that sort of thing that dealers can sometimes do.
I have one last question for you. I want to say that, you know, this kid from the Upper West Side, where you grew up in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, who's tooling around New Mexico with a guitar. He doesn't know what he wants to do. He's running for the Santa Fe sports page. And then you enter a world in which you see a lot of things and you experience a lot of things. And one of them is love.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is you meet your wife.
Yes.
In the towers of Manhattan, shall we say.
Yes, I think that's fair to say.
How did that happen?
Well, my wife, Gayford Steinberg, was married to a very well-known titan of Wall Street, Saul Steinberg. No secret there. They had a wonderful marriage for many years, but he did eventually die after a long lingering situation. I knew Gayford through a few different women who are sort of hostesses around town, mm-hmm. who would have me as a single guy at the table. And I remember meeting her a first time and just being dazzled by her intelligence, her beauty. And so some months after Saul died, I just thought, God, I really loved talking to that woman. Let's just invite her to lunch and see what happens. And we went to lunch and we had a great time and we went to dinner and one thing led to another. So that was, we are celebrating our fifth anniversary on Saturday.
Michael Schneerson, his latest book is Boom. If you want to hear more about the social scene at the height of the 1980s, you can't get a better storyteller than Tina Brown, who took over Vanity Fair just in time to document that period's excesses.
We were in the Reagan era, right? We just, Ronald Reagan was on a glide path to re-election. I came in as a London outsider who didn't know really much about America, and I was just plunged into this world of Reagan's America, which was this kind of black tie, wildly consumerist, you know.
Bob Colicello-esque.
Bob Colicello, he was on the magazine.
Sure.
It was just, I mean, it boggles my mind when I read the diaries now and when I started to compile them, how much we went out.
For a link to my full interview with Tina Brown, text Tina to 70101. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Richard Feigen's New York Gallery has sold hundreds of millions of dollars of the greatest works of art, from the Renaissance through Basquiat. His expertise is the Italian Baroque. He was one of the most important dealers to the newly minted millionaires of 1980s New York, who all bought their art and their cultural cachet from Feigen. As Sotheby's put it, quote, Richard's secret is to buy what's not in fashion
and to trust his keen eye for quality, unquote. In recent years, he's been stepping back from the day-to-day leadership of the gallery, but his taste is still evident in its choices. Just this year, before the pandemic hit, they put up an exhibit of old master and 19th century drawings. Richard Feigen's a dealer, but says he's really a collector, a passion he's had his entire life.
The 11-year-old Richard Feigen earned $100, and the first thing I bought was $100.
You bought a painting for $100?
Yes.
And when you told your parents you were going to take the $100 of your personal fortune, all of your personal fortune, and buy a painting with it, what did they say?
I don't think they much interfered. They just
didn't?
No.
As long as you were happy.
Yeah.
As long as you left them alone, didn't bother them. He's going to go buy a painting. Okay, so what? Let him go buy some paintings. And you bought what painting?
I bought a Flemish painting from the 16th century in an antique store near where I lived for $100.
And what was it about? Meaning, was it really about an appreciation of art?
Partially. Partially, it was financial.
At 11?
Yeah.
You understood the equity involved at that age?
Yes.
Because you were surrounded by, your father was successful?
Yeah, but he was a lawyer. They didn't have any art.
They didn't have any art?
No.
So what's the 2001 A Space Odyssey moment for you when the black monolith shows up in your bedroom and tells you need to go out and buy art?
I don't know. I guess I recognized the values, and I felt that there was a vast difference between price and value, so I decided to take advantage of that. And then I ended up selling it for $100. It was not a very successful deal.
No, it wasn't a score.
No.
It wasn't a big coup for you. Does this progress? Was it a one-off? Or did you keep going, even when you were 11? You kept going?
I kept going.
When did the aesthetic enter the picture?
It entered it fairly early as I got more involved. And I got to understand more. Then the aesthetic took over. In the beginning, I went to work for a company that was in my family, an insurance company on the West Coast.
Right. Beneficial Standard?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy that?
I enjoyed the investment aspect, but the art that I wanted to chase was in New York. So I arranged to buy art for the chairman of our company, which brought me to New York frequently. And then I ended up staying in New York.
You sold your seat on the exchange in 57. You were on the stock exchange?
Yes, yes. One of the great Wall Street figures told me that I wouldn't like it, and he was right. So that I only had that seat for about a year.
And you dumped your seat on the stock exchange?
I dumped it.
I sold it for a lot of money.
I broke even at it. It cost me $50,000. I had about $6,000 of initiation fees or whatever, and I sold it for $56,000.
$56,000. Exactly what I paid. In 57. To start your own art business, your own gallery.
Yes.
But then when you open up Richard Feigen, your first company, you've got to get money to go buy paint. Or do they consign the paintings?
I have things on consignment.
And when did things begin to change for you? When did you start to really take off, if you will, and sell more paintings and build your business?
Well, when I got to know the collectors and the museums, I became very much involved with a number of museums. And I began to either know what they wanted or what they ought to want. And then I had to convince them of what they ought to want if they're lacking certain things.
So museums themselves are clients of yours?
Oh, yes, a lot of museums.
Right. Was there a sale or a transaction that you facilitated back then that really began to make your reputation? Was there one you recall where you thought that was a big turning point for my company?
I don't think there was a single
instance. Right.
But I've dealt with most of the major museums in the world. I mean, the Metropolitan, National Gallery, the Louvre, and so on. And I would spend time, look at their collection, decide they need such and such a painting, and then if I had it, I would offer it to them. Hopefully they would agree with me.
Someone that you were an early proponent of was Bacon, who I am a great admirer of. So I'm assuming you knew him. You must have known him, correct?
I never met Bacon.
You never did?
I had the first Bacon show, I think, in America. But I didn't deal with him directly.
You didn't?
I just bought up his work around, because I admired it. Right. he originally said he was going to come to my opening. And I thought that was great. And then I later got a call that he wanted me to fix him up with some young boys. And I said, I'm out of my water here. I'm not up to this. I couldn't handle it. So I dissuaded him from coming.
Your one chance to meet Bacon.
I suppose I could have met him otherwise.
Had you been willing to pimp for Bacon, you might have had a nice friendship.
Yeah, I might have.
You might have had a hell of a friendship.
Ended up in jail or something.
Well, who knows? Who knows?
Yeah. But when I can't remember the exact timing, but I bought my Francis Bacon show. The whole show of 14 paintings cost me an average of probably $600-$700 a painting.
Right.
And I sold them for $1,000, $1,200. Paintings that are individually worth now
hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars, yeah.
How would you describe the art market today compared to when you first arrived here and moved here in the 60s? And
well, I think the art market is much, much larger now, much more international.
Right.
And the focus has changed a lot. Right now, the old master market is largely dead, unless you have something extraordinary that nobody's ever seen before. There's a very small market for old masters, largely contemporary. And that's where all the focus and the spotlight has been on the contemporary. So I may see permanent value in things and end up buying it when there isn't that much of a market for it.
I think when you see someone, you read about them in the paper, and they say that this guy bought this painting, Picasso or whatever, some huge name in that world, and they paid $500 million for the painting. They paid the highest amount ever paid. Do those people always assume that the day will come that they'll sell that painting for more than $500 million, or do they ever sit there and say, "I don't care about that. I just want that painting because I love that painting." It's always about, or is it always about, equity and markets and resale eventually?
I think it depends a lot on the individual, I think if they're spending that kind of money, usually they have to be assured that the intrinsic value is there and will
always
be there.
They're going to get it back, yeah.
Some people don't much care. For some people, that $500 million may not be that much.
The documentary that you were in, The Art of the Steal, I want to get to something about that in a moment. But another documentary I saw, they showed Koons standing in a laboratory-like setting with a bunch of his disciples, and they're all applying paint to these canvases and under his direction. And they're asking him, basically, is it a Koons if your hand never touches the brush? And he was unrepentant. He said, what they're doing is completely at my direction. And there was a bunch of them working simultaneously. He's going from canvas to canvas to...
Well, he has a sort of a factory, I think, downtown.
Now, what do you think about that?
I think a lot of these values are confections. And I think that Jeff Koons is a very sophisticated and clever guy and is a substantial buyer of old master pictures, which I understand a lot of them are on loan to the Metropolitan Museum.
Things he bought, Koons.
Things he bought. And he's very sophisticated. I do not believe he's an artist of any consequence.
You don't?
No, a lot of people would differ with me on that.
Right.
I don't think so.
You never transacted a Koons. You never bought and
sold. I've never bought or sold a Koons.
No, because you didn't want to.
No, I don't get involved in things where I have doubts about the intrinsic value there.
Ever?
No, really not. And I don't consider Jeff Koons an artist of consequence.
Do you think there's a market for a place, a gallery to open, in which you have, the curators of the gallery, let's say, are people with some experience, and on the walls they hang art of people that are undiscovered, that they really, really believe in, and all the art is for argument's sake, you know, under $25,000. It's not super expensive. It's not no six-figure purchases there, maybe even under $10,000. Do you think there's a market for that? Do you think people want to come in and they want to look at art? Or do most people who have money to buy art, they're big game hunters? They want famous big pieces and feathers in their cap and so forth.
I think there's very little now that remains undiscovered. The market has expanded, and there's so many people in it that, and you can't predict which things are going to be successful or not. I remember years ago, I was in Japan with a very dear friend of mine, Jim Rosenquist, who just died last year. And we were in this gallery, and in walks the artist Kusama. Her work at that time was very inexpensive. Since then, they've gotten expensive, and you couldn't have predicted that. For me, it's relatively easy to tell which things have permanent importance. That doesn't mean that they're ever going to be picked up by the market.
Yeah, collectible.
Expensive. There are things today that I'm just flabbergasted at the prices they bring, because I don't regard them as being intrinsically very significant. Whereas 5 years ago, they cost very little. Now the prices are enormous. That doesn't happen very often, and you can't tell which things are going to have that kind of appreciation.
The documentary that you were in, Art of the Steal.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite documentaries about the acquisition of the Barnes collection.
Yeah.
Folded into the Philadelphia Museum and all the Sturm and Drang about that. And there you are at an exhibit, I think it's either Christie's or Sotheby's, and you say some art, my favorite quote, some art is attractive and not very significant, significant and not very attractive. And then you point to a painting and say, now this painting is neither significant nor attractive, but it'll sell for $30 million or some obscene amount of money.
Yeah, I got a lot of flack out of that.
Did you really?
Yeah. No, and the Barnes is a very good example, because the Barnes Foundation, I was very much opposed to moving it.
Right.
And they wanted it downtown for tourist reasons. I always maintained that it was fine where it was. Mm-hmm. And if they wanted to make it accessible to the general public, they could have run shuttle buses back and forth. It was only about a 15-minute trip. I visited it down in Philadelphia. They've tried to recreate the hanging
the rooms,
of the paintings,
yeah,
and so on. I think that was absurd. I think it's been successful. I assume there are crowds of people that come and see it.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think it could have been handled in their other building where they were, which was an admirable building. I don't think they had to move it.
If you go to one city and you're going to go and see the art in that city, you're going to pick one. Which one would you pick?
I would probably pick London.
You would? Why?
Because the National Gallery has a great collection. The Tate Gallery has always been very active. It's a real, and the new British artists continue to be very important. They were, when I was involved with giving exhibitions, I focused on the new generation of British artists. It's no longer a new generation. They're now older, much revered group of artists. But they've had a very significant role in what's going on today. So I think that Tate is important. The National Gallery in London is important, and so on.
Now, in your own home, is art something that certain pieces survive and they stay there forever? There are pieces that you have on a wall and they're never going to leave that wall and they live there forever, pieces you love? Or does the art in your home change over time?
No, the stuff in my home generally is stuff that I own personally and is pretty stable. It stays there.
Right. Stuff you love.
Oh, I have a pretty large group of very early Italian pictures from the from the 14th, 15th centuries, which is a period that interests me a lot.
Why?
First of all, I like it aesthetically, and secondly, it's important in terms of the evolution of art history. Some of the things in that period interest me intellectually. So I have a large group of those things. Mm-hmm. Every now and then I give something to the Yale Art Gallery. Mm-hmm.
But so you have, beyond your home and in your gallery, do you have in storage tons and tons of pieces that you own?
Not tons and tons of things.
But some?
Some things I have, but I don't keep it in storage. It usually is on my wall in my home if it's personal.
Or in a gallery.
Or in my gallery, okay. And I don't generally change that around that much. There's not that much that interests me enough to buy it. I don't have that big a diverse an inventory.
Richard Feigen. Last year, Feigen sold some of those personal treasures to fund his retirement. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.